Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Kevin Suarez, and coming up on the program... Cryptocurrencies haven't had a good beginning to the year, facing opposition from businessmen, companies, and even entire countries. I explored whether their opposition is pragmatic or just hype backlash. Also on the show, we're continuing our feature on the history of macroeconomic thought with Emeritus Professor Frank Stillwell. All this and more coming up on The Money. The TPP has been a hotly contested topic for a few years now. A delayed signing, Canada's unexplained absence, and one final meeting later, the multilateral agreement looks to be signed in March. But who wins, and what is Trump's role in how the TPP plays out? Hans Lee spoke to Tim Harcourt, the airport economist, to find out more. He started by asking him about the political ramifications and whether signing the TPP is as good as the government says it is.
It's quite significant. You know, we've seen the WTO as dead as Doha in recent years. So it's sort of that is a significant thing. In another sense, having an agreement that includes Asian countries, includes Canada, includes Latin America, Australia and New Zealand, that's also good in terms of the diversity across the Pacific. And in some areas like agriculture, we've been waiting for a reduction in trade barriers for a long time in those sectors, so that's quite good news.
What industries should get the most out of the TPP?
I think from an Australian point of view, you know, things like beef and rice will do well, dairy and so on. I think it'd be good for, you know, manufacturing sectors from Japan. I think for Australia, professional services, architects into Singapore and so on will be good. So I think across agriculture, we'll probably go from the, you know, mining boom to the dining boom with agriculture, do quite well in professional services, and it'll probably, you know, have some overall macroeconomic benefit globally.
Yeah, I was going to say agriculture is a really important benefit of the TPP, and you were alluding there to professional services. Is that an opportunity for Australia to, say, export its education or its tourism services without tariffs or without greater penalties?
Yeah, I think so. Things like architecture, you know, that's traditionally been quite difficult because, obviously, governments favour their locals. So I think it allows, you know, allows architects to tender for government work and government procurement and pick up, you know they're building the Great Mall of, you know, China, but also other parts of Asia are building rapidly, so it'll be allow Australian companies to get involved in infrastructure, so that's a benefit. So I think, I mean, in terms of size and scale, I would say the government's right in terms of it having some, you know, significant scale and significant size.
So although the TPP is to be signed in March, when can we really start to see the real effects of the TPP coming through to Australian consumers?
I don't think they're things that hit your hip pocket tomorrow. I think they're more jobs and better consumer prices and more opportunities over 5 to 10 years. You know, Australia opened up its economy significantly in the 80s with the Hawke-Keating reforms, and we've had 27 years of economic expansion. So it's taken a long time and a gradual time for those benefits to come through. So I think of trade deals as a marathon, not a sprint.
Well, the drama of the TPP, well before March, well before this re-signing, has always been US President Donald Trump's hostility towards multilateral trade agreements. Firstly, Tim, he said in the past that the TPP is ridiculous, amongst other memorable quotes, but he's turned around at the World Economic Forum in Davos, hinting that a better deal may woo him and the US back. What do you think that better deal would look like?
Well, Trump's always said he's not against free trade. Trump's always said America's made lousy deals. And he presented himself as candidate Trump as the art of the deal, the guy who can do the best deal for America. So I think with him, I think he's just saying with TPP or NAFTA or any of the agreements that the US has done with Japan or China, that he can improve the terms of the US. Now, unfortunately, the way Trump talks, and a lot of people do this, is they talk about a trade win as only the US exporting and only the US benefiting, whilst in actual fact, a good trade deal means that you increase exports and imports simultaneously. It's not, you know, it's not a win to have a trade surplus with every country in the world. It could actually be detrimental to you as well as detrimental to your trade partner.
Well, he's even said that he prefers bilateral agreements over multilateral trade agreements. And you were just mentioning NAFTA there, which I think is really interesting, because his administration is renegotiating NAFTA, and now he's hinted support of the TPP when he, during the 2016 election campaign, went on a huge protectionist campaign. So which version of Donald Trump should Canberra believe?
Well, I think with Donald Trump, always with trade policy, is he'll make some outrageous statements, he'll put a few things on Twitter, he'll have a few wins, like a couple of car plants agreeing to stay in Michigan or set one up in Alabama rather than set one up in Mexico. So all he needs is a few high-profile wins in the states that he won off the Democrats, like a Michigan, and then he can declare victory. And if the United States job market continues to improve on the back of Janet Yellen's fine work at the Fed, then he can really declare victory and not change trade policy too much at all. And one thing about the United States is that trade policy is made by Congress. They give the president fast-track negotiating, but for the most part, trade is also done in the Congress. So really, I think Trump will use his bully pulpit, his Twitter account, to beat up on a few American companies who he can claim are not doing the right thing. But I don't think he will rip up the American the international trade architecture as much as he claims he said he would.
Well, Australia has welcomed this change. Mr. Turnbull said something about that. And I guess in some ways, well, at least to the eyes of the media and the liberal elites in Davos, it could be seen as a move back towards the liberal economic order. Do you think, Tim, it was necessary for Australia to be outspoken about this turn of events?
I think Australia's always been a leader on multilateralism and always been a leader on having an international trade presence, partly because we were penalised as an agricultural exporter by the policies of the US and the European Union so drastically. So we've always been a leader on multilateral trade liberalisation, and I think as a middle power we should do, because we've had a good track record and we've got a good story to tell in terms of trade. I think the things that perhaps the elites in Davos may miss, and people on the right miss probably deliberately, is that trade is necessary but not sufficient. You can have an open trade regime, but if you're undercutting your own country with bad industrial relations policies or bad healthcare policies or education policies, then trade's not going to do any good for you at all. I mean, the important thing about the Hawke-Keating era is that they opened up the economy, but they brought in Medicare and superannuation, and they had a cord to manage wages and growth expectations and to allow productivity to grow along with wage growth. So I think your domestic policy should be progressive, you know, protecting the vulnerable, protecting parts of the labour market that can be hurt, whilst you open up your economy.
Let's just finish by addressing China. In both revisions, China is not at the negotiating table. By keeping China not at the table, do you think that signing the TPP will only infuriate Australia-China relations further?
I think, I think China's got a legitimate reason to be more of a global player and to be part of global institutions, but it's also got more global responsibility. I think Australia should have been quicker to sign up to the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and as was Australia, always very pro-China when it came to joining the WTO and so on. But if a trade deal is in our interests and it involves Japan and other allies, then there's no reason for China to be upset by it. I mean, we've had a commercial agreement with Japan since 1957. And until 10 years ago, Japan was our number one trading partner. So I would have thought strong ties between Japan and Australia is only to China's benefit.
Too many good things to talk about in Asia, as always. Tim Harcourt, the Airport Economist, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Hans. Always love talking to you. Thank you.
Tim Harcourt, the Airport Economist, ending that report by Hans Lee. You're listening to On The Money, finding out everything to do with money, finance and business. And we're broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney. I'm Kevin Suarez.
Please explain. Please explain.
And now we have part four of our series on macroeconomics by Veronica Alishina.
Supply and demand, bubbles and recessions, GDP and FDI. These are just some of the topics dominating our current discourse about economics. But how are these ideas connected, and where did they come from? I asked Professor Frank Stillwell why these topics dominate our conversations and whether our strong focus on microeconomics needs a macroeconomic counterpoint. We're talking neoclassical economic theory.
So the myth is that neoclassical economics helps us to understand the real world. It doesn't. In the 20th century, it's developed as a sort of almost unquestioned orthodoxy. Students go to university, 9 cases out of 10, this is what they learn. It's in the standard textbooks. The basic courses represent this ideology as if it were science.
So, Professor Stillwell, how did we get from Smith to here?
Classical economics really was the period of the 19th century. Big thinkers like David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill were reflecting about how economic change under a capitalist system could help lead to social progress. Marx gave it a bit of a jolt, I have to say, along the way, but arguably the neoclassical economists at the end of the century put it onto a much safer track.
And what did that involve? What are the principles underlying our contemporary economic system?
Narrowing the questions to really just the study of market behaviour. Mobilising the apparatus of demand and supply theory to explain how markets work. And presenting it all in a very favourable light, because according to neoclassical theorists, self-interested consumers come to the market where they interact with self-interested producers, they haggle, they establish equilibrium prices at which mutually advantageous exchanges occur. Win-win. No losers. Everything harmonious, progressive, want-satisfying. It's a very pro-capitalist ideology.
In essence, there are two neoclassical economic concepts we need to understand in order to grasp market theory: the relationship between demand and supply, and the role of markets.
Yes. In a market, there are always two types of participants: the people who bring the goods to the market in the hope of selling them to at a profit, and the consumers who come to the market in the hope of buying things that they need or satisfy their wants, and to do that as cheaply as possible. So there's a basic conflict of interest there. Sellers want to sell high, buyers want to buy cheap, you know, for a given quality of the product. But what do markets do? According to neoclassical economics, they produce harmony out of this structural conflict. Markets establish the equilibrium prices at which trades occur. Everyone's happy.
So, a simple want-satisfying system. But what happens when we consider the advent of modern marketing?
This is where the theory starts to break down. If you assume a consumer with a given set of wants, then you might say, well, market mechanism is quite a good way of satisfying those wants. But once you recognise that the sellers are also persuading the consumers to want things, Once you see capitalism as a want creation rather than a want satisfying mechanism, then there's frankly no end to it. Consumers may shop around, they may look at all the choices available to them in the market, they may act in that sort of sense rationally, but over time, a collectively irrational outcome occurs where we all are consuming much more stuff, probably feeling no happier at the end of it, but absolutely destroying the planet in the process.
Professor Stilwell has a famous analogy which aptly explains this phenomenon, called the principle of marginal utility.
You imagine someone perhaps dying of thirst in a desert, and then they're offered one glass of water. It's literally a lifesaver. Whatever money they had in their pocket, they would gladly get it out because the value of that first glass of water is almost infinite. Then they're offered a second glass of water. Well, that would be nice to have too as a supplementary thirst quencher. But the third one, frankly, fourth, fifth, sixth, 700th, you don't need it, or not then anyway. You might over your lifetime, but as a consumer at that point of time, what you can see has happened is that you've got diminishing marginal utility from each additional glass of water. And that applies to most things. Nice to have one car, but do you really get 10 times as much benefit out of having 10 cars? Clothing. I mean, of course you want something to on your back to keep the sun off your skin and keep you warm in the winter. But you know, do you really need 100 blouses or shirts? You know, and what extra benefit will you get out of having 101?
On one hand, demand and supply, and on the other, marketing, advertising, and corporate responsibility. These are big questions for us all to consider going forward.
Neoclassical economics is a theory about a free market economy. The myth is that the real world is like that. In practice, the real world is all to do with powerful institutions that sometimes compete, sometimes cooperate, sometimes conspire. And to imply that it's all operating according to the principles of demand and supply and equilibrium in markets is frankly misleading. It's ideological, it's not scientific.
I hope you all feel that it's easy to understand economics after that part of the story of economics from Veronica Alishina.
On the Money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
Cryptocurrencies have been making the news recently, and not for the right reasons. Businessmen have spoken out against it, a $500 million theft occurred, companies are banning advertisements for cryptocurrencies, and even an entire country considered banning cryptocurrency trading. So is there a growing backlash against the online money, or is there a reason why these organizations have spoken out against it? Over the past month, cryptocurrencies have been attracting controversy due to several reasons. South Korea have considered banning their citizens from trading cryptocurrencies, while Facebook banned Bitcoin advertisements, and other incidents occurred which forced crypto consumers to reconsider their investments on Bitcoin. I spoke to Adrian Lee, a senior lecturer of the Finance Discipline Group, about whether cryptocurrencies will be impacted by the recent negative PR. At the end of January, Facebook banned all advertisements for cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin. I asked Mr. Lee whether this could impact any interest Facebook users may have in investing with Bitcoins.
Facebook has just banned the ads for cryptocurrencies and binary options on it. So that's just because they're afraid that people will be scammed. That's the official line, that they're afraid that some of these ads are scam ads and they're not actually buying Bitcoin. They might be just giving money away to criminals, basically. So that's not, I wouldn't call that backlash. It's just to avoid people being scammed, their users being scammed.
Okay, and so could the customers end up being dissuaded if they see in big letters, you know, Facebook banning Bitcoin ads? Could this dissuade them from buying Bitcoin through other more official means?
I don't think it. I mean, advertising would always help Bitcoin. The more interest there is, the more people who want to trade in Bitcoin. But if you're a keen enthusiast, then you would not be swayed. You'd already know these official channels through other websites, and then you'd go through these exchanges anyway.
South Korean officials have been deliberating on whether or not cryptocurrency trading should be banned within their country or not. The Justice Minister, Park Sang-ki, attracted controversy when he announced that a ban on cryptocurrency trading was in progress. However, Finance Minister Kim Dong-yong announced later that month no bans or limitations will be put in place. I asked Mr. Lee what could potentially drive an entire government to ban their citizens from trading in cryptocurrency.
So initially, the Korean ban, it wasn't... The main reason was because they were afraid of the speculation in Bitcoin in Korea. The fact that the price in Korean won was a large premium to this US dollar. So that was the main reason. But now they've actually changed their tact. They've said, we're not going to ban it, but we're going to regulate it and say, you must register to use the exchange, and that's to avoid money laundering and other illicit means for transferring your Korean won into Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
So do you feel that people would still continue trading through, like South Koreans would still continue trading business as normal for the people that aren't using it for more illicit means?
That's correct. And you can see it from the statistics that the Korean won to US Bitcoin trading is still quite high. So it's still business as usual. It hasn't deterred people from trading Bitcoin in South Korea.
Billionaire Warren Buffett has been an outspoken critic of cryptocurrencies since the beginning of the decade. He said around the middle of January that Bitcoin will have a bad ending. So I asked Mr. Lee whether the people and companies of Silicon Valley have begun turning their back on cryptocurrencies.
If you move against it, then others will trade it. And others will still keep developing Bitcoin and blockchain technology. So that underlying technology is not going away. The investment into it may be reduced should there be a large crash and people sort of realize, oh, maybe it's not that useful, this Bitcoin, the potential of it. So, you know, Warren Buffett is a bricks and mortars type guy. He likes value. And because Bitcoin has no underlying cash flow in it, then, of course, he'd always say, no, this is it looks like a scam. So do not invest in it.
So in a place like Silicon Valley, where it's basically built on the future of technology, is the fact that all of these companies and all of these billionaires saying maybe it's not such a good idea, do you think that might come back to bite them?
I mean, there's many technologies to invest in, not just blockchain. And also, you don't have to just invest in cryptocurrency. You can invest in blockchain and improve it or some alternative to it. So it doesn't hurt more development in this sort of different way of recording transactions.
So just to clarify, I'm not as familiar with blockchain. Can you just elaborate on what it is?
Sure. So blockchain is what's called a distributed ledger. Basically, people using the blockchain, say in Bitcoin, they all hold the record of transactions in Bitcoin as a public record. So then this ensures the transactions are all safe and verified because everyone can see them. Whereas usually you have a centralized system to hold a public record, which has risks involved.
And finally, the end of last month saw the most expensive Bitcoin theft in history, with over $500 million worth of the cryptocurrency stolen. I asked Mr. Lee if thefts of this magnitude will be an increasingly common occurrence in the future.
It's happened in the past. For example, Mt. Gox was hacked, and it caused its demise. And as long as Bitcoin's very valuable and these exchanges do not keep up their security, then hackers always have incentive to try to steal Bitcoin from them. So just keep in mind that it's not the blockchain technology they're trying to bypass, but it's actually the weakness of the exchange's security websites in storing the passwords to access the wallets.
Adrian Lee, a senior lecturer of the Finance Discipline Group at the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report there. And that's all the time that we have for On the Money.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
That's all we have time for On The Money this week. We hope you'll tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about money, finance and business. Hello if you're listening to 2RRR from Gladesville and 7RGY in Geaveston. Thanks executive producer Roderick Chambers, technical producer Vincent Su and producer Veronica Alishina. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Put it on your friend's phone as well. Follow us on Twitter and look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook. I'm Kevin Suarez. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Something about Sydney? A query about Queenscliff? A pondering about Paddington? A thought about Thornlie? A reflection on Randwick? A postulation on Parramatta? A musing of Marrickville? 2SER is seeking Sydney. Head over to 2SER.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate and answer. While you're there, why not vote for your favourite question? 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
What's your New Year's resolution?
Start a vinyl collection? Make record collector friends?
Get out and about in Newtown?
Start your vinyl new year at Newtown Record Fair. The first one for 2018, with 5,000 plus vinyl records, live DJs, a tasty menu and craft beers on tap. 2SER presents Newtown Record Fair, Saturday 3rd of February, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. in the back beer garden at the Bank Hotel, King Street, Newtown. NewtownRecordFair.com.au, a resolute sponsor of 2SER.
Spirits Rejoice, a special summer series of spiritual jazz on 2SER every Saturday at 5 p.m. Take a journey each week with a soundtrack to a radical age of black power and cosmic communion. Spirits Rejoice, celebrating an explosive, exciting time when jazz got spiritual. 5 p.m. Saturdays on 2SER 107.3.